What's up, Oos? Main Event Jey Uso here from the WWE. When it's just me between matches, it's day one-ish. And that means it's Chumba time. With hundreds of casino-style games and new titles arriving weekly, there's always something fresh to try at Chumba Casino. The daily boosts make it even more fun. And have me, about to get them, all during my downtime. Ready for a fun way to chill out and enjoy a few minutes for yourself? Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
From NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Truth and Justice. On this season of Justice Warriors, we've been talking to people who were doing good work in the criminal justice space and trying to seek justice. And we had a big variety of people, everybody from other content creators to people doing work outside of the content creation field. And my guest today is a longtime friend of mine, somebody that has been working in the space, one of, if not the OG of the true crime podcasting space, if not definitely one of them, is my good friend Aaron Habel, who you know, I'm sure, from the Generation Y podcast, but also from the podcast he does by himself called Framed. And Framed has just launched into his third season. And in this season, he's covering a case that a lot of people are maybe familiar with. A lot of other podcasts have talked about it in kind of one-off episodes. But Aaron is taking it on from a completely different direction than anything I've heard before. I saw that he published it, listened to the first couple episodes that just dropped this week, and right away reached out to him, asked if he wanted to come on the show. So first of all, Aaron, thanks for joining me. It's good to see you, man.
Man, so good to see you. Happy to be here.
So the case we're talking about is, we talked about this a little bit off air. We had a conversation yesterday, and you told me, you know, you're covering the Scott Macklem case. And I had told you on the phone before I had listened to the episodes that I was like, no, I'm not familiar with that case. And then, you know, I got right on the podcast and started listening, and then realized pretty quickly that the person that is convicted for this crime, potentially wrongfully convicted of this crime, is a guy named, I always pronounce it wrong, Temujin Kensu, right? That's how we
correct.
Pronounce his name. Yeah, the Kensu case. So, and I was familiar with that case. It's actually not from, it's from Michigan. It's not far away from me. As a matter of fact, I was in where he is imprisoned, where you went to visit him. In Montcalm County, I was just driving through there yesterday, you know, right near where the prison's at. Was very, you know, well, somewhat familiar with that case. But what I liked immediately about the way you are presenting this case is you're not billing it as the Kensu case. It's the murder of Scott Macklem, which is, you know, you're putting focus on the victim, which I feel like most people have never really done with, well, a lot of cases, but particularly this case. So first of all, hats off to you for, and it makes me feel bad because it's one of the things that I'm so always focused on is focusing on the victims. And it's like, here's another case where I didn't know what you were talking about because you were talking about the victim instead of the person convicted of it. Real quick, I want to start out. How did you land on, because you haven't released a season in about 3 years, right? The last season aired in 2023.
Oh, I think it's been 2022 since anything came out before on Framed and Investigative Story, but yeah, it's a lot of behind the scenes stuff and the team and changing people behind the scenes. And so it came to a point where I just said, I really need to do this again. And so, yeah, it took a lot of work finding the right people to work with. And here I am. It's been a long journey.
How did you land on the Scott Macklem case?
Well, I want to address that real quick when it comes to victims and how they're forgotten. It's not even really that anybody means any kind of ill will there. What happens is when someone is killed, there's a little bit of information about them that comes out that they lit up a room or they had a family. But at the end of the day, what happens is law enforcement will identify a suspect or suspects, and the media will start digging in on who those suspects are. The victim is forgotten almost immediately, not because no one cares about the victim, but because they're almost a footnote in their own story. And then we want to know, can this person be the one that killed them? We dig into their past. We find out more about what they've been up to, what they've said in the past. Are there pictures? Are there videos? So it's not that anybody means any harm. And for me, the best way I could honor the victim here is to put their name in episode one.
Yeah, I love that. Yeah, the first episode is out of I think it's out of the murder of Scott Macklem, right? Is episode one. And you go into just incredible, incredible detail. You can tell you've done a ton of research. And the narrative debt and the way you write is driving me crazy, in a good way. Whereas, yeah, we get this, you open up with this trip to the prison to go talk to Kenzu. And then it goes, and then we jump back and we get the whole story of the murder and the background of Scott and all this stuff. And then we get a little bit more of a teaser about this interview. And then it's back into the background of Kenzu, who was Fred Freeman at the time, was the name he went by. So first of all, when are we gonna hear this interview? I'm super intrigued. Were you able to record in the prison?
Well, let me address a couple of things there. So a lot of the writing was actually done by Kathleen McGrath. And I worked with her on this because she's able to lay everything out and then I can go back in and make changes. So I would say she did a lot of the work. That's why I say on most of the episodes it says primary research and writing by. And she's been a wonderful partner on this. As far as meeting with Temujin, the idea was that I would go and visit him and get a sense of who he was. Now, most people who get a chance to speak with him, and I had previously by phone, you ask him questions. You want to know what his answers will be. By the time I went to visit him, I didn't have those questions anymore. And I think it took him aback because he's thinking, wait, you didn't ask me any questions in the prison really about the case that I'm in prison for. And, you know, how do you answer that for somebody? For me, the question really over time has become, who really is Temujin Kenzu? What is he all about? Because not everybody likes him. There's a whole long list of people that don't care for him, his personality, and the way that he does things because he's very involved. Once you make a connection with him, he wants to, you know, tell you the story from his point of view. He wants you to, you know, maybe not address certain things. He wouldn't explain it that way, but I'm saying from my experience, he really likes to control the narrative. Now, when I met him, I wanted to get a sense of exactly who he was so I could ask him certain questions and see what his answers were. And I think maybe later he realized, wait, he's actually trying to figure out me, not my case. I'd already figured out the case.
So were you able to record it, or is what we're hearing in like episode two, like the information you got from your discussion with him? Because we get a lot of his background in that second episode.
No, really. I mean, honestly, I'm not able to record. They had some very tight controls at the prison. If you listen to the episode, you'll know that they hand me a big black box with a red button on it.
Yeah, I heard
and,
that.
You know, at first you just think, well, I'm not going to need this. I mean, you take it, but you're like, I won't need this because you're going to see someone who wants out of prison. If they attack you, they're not coming out of prison, right?
Yeah.
It's very simple. So I'm in the prison and I noticed that over time, the box ended up closer and closer to him because I would fiddle with it here and there and kind of turn it a little bit or just look at it. And eventually I thought, I better take this box and put it back by me. I mean, it's probably the protocol. But when I left the prison, I actually looked at the officials and said, thank you for looking out for my safety. Because, you know, at the end of the day, you don't really know. You don't really know what someone's going to do. I didn't know him. You know, I talked to him a few times on the phone or whatever and exchanged messages. But, you know, you go and meet him in person and it's just like I thought. He was turning on the charm left and right, turning it up to 11.
Yeah. And it was so interesting because, you know, I've talked to and visited and interviewed people in prison several times, never in Michigan. So I was the first thing I noticed is how different Michigan, my home state, is in as far as their security. So, for example, you know, I've visited several people in Texas and I'd visit like Ed Ates many times in prison there. And one, because I wasn't family, I was never able to have a contact visit where I was like in a room where I would get a, you know, needed a box like that.
That's
I visited. Yeah. There's always glass between us. It's in a row. And then as far as, like you said, recording in prisons is very difficult. I was able to record Ed in the prison one time. And the only way I was able to do that was through the legal team and actually the production team. I was filming the documentary, the Forgotten West Memphis 3 documentary, but I was attached to Herzog, the production company. and they had the credentials that the prison requires for, because an independent podcaster doesn't meet, at least in Texas, the requirements to go in and be do a media interview. But I was able to get the team from Herzog to submit a request that they wanted to interview Ed Aides, and I was the reporter going in to do it. And that's the only way I was able to do that. So that was the first thing. Like, when you were describing that at the beginning of episode one, I'm like, oh shit, he got in. And then you talked about that box they gave you. It was like, you were like, even when I interviewed Ed, like as a media interviewer, they allowed me to record, there was still glass between us. Like, I had to give his microphone to the guard who took it around to him, put him on. I had to like talk him through setting the microphone up on his shirt, you know, from the other side of the glass. So it was a completely different experience. And for you, did you just visit as a friend visit?
I contacted the person at the prison who authorizes visits for prisoners. Mm-hmm. And I had to explain who I was. I had to give over some personal information. Yeah, there were lots of things I had to go through, some hoops. And it was also difficult to schedule, because the person who you schedule with, I don't know if they're just really busy or if they don't particularly like doing this or whatever. But,
yeah,
you know, we got around to getting it done. And yeah, I would say that's the surprising thing. Everyone else I know that's gone and spoken with him in prison went there to ask him questions about the case. I have this mindset that whether they could be innocent or whether they could be guilty, I don't know that I'm going to get the information I need by asking them the questions. I need to look at this as independently as possible. What do I gain from asking questions about the case? They might tell me something and then I can fact check it. And then they might tell me that my facts are wrong. So I don't know that I gain anything by asking the questions. It's not a gotcha moment. It's more of a, I want to see what this person does when I ask them certain questions.
So when you took on this season of Framed, what is your end goal? I remember I don't think I ever got a chance to listen to season two, but I listened to season one of Framed. And I remember at the very beginning of that season, and we'll circle back a little bit and kind of give people kind of the breakdown of your other two seasons. But I remember, like you said, like, my goal here is to solve this case. And it was very clear that was what you were attempting to do. What are you hoping to do with this case, with the murder of Scott Macklem?
Well, the first two seasons of Framed, I worked with a guy named Jake. And Jake is a brilliant researcher, I can tell you that. And he's the one that had contacts with people in those cases, and he felt that we could solve them. And mm-hmm. So I don't know. I think we got close to figuring out what really happened in season two with the murder of 9 monks in their temple, their Buddhist temple in Arizona. Mm-hmm. I feel like season one, that case was solved. But we cannot solve it officially because of legal red tape and government red tape.
Right.
We were told by people, we are not going to go where you're asking us to go. And so it's very frustrating when we could have broken the case open and solved it. But that's the way life works sometimes. You can't always get a win, even if you can see it and you can smell it. Season three is far different. This season is not something where I can solve. And I'll tell you on the outset here, there's a lot of debate over whether Temujin Kensu is a guilty man or not. We know he was found guilty in a court of law. That can be debated in terms of what they used to convict him. But when it comes down to it, the real question is why are we having the debate at all? This case is very simple. It was investigated by a beat cop who not only was just a beat cop, but he was a disgraced beat cop who had been fired previously for allowing criminal activities to go on under his watch. So when they brought him in, he had no professional experience investigating a crime, and he was the one in charge of this case. And after this case, he was put back on the streets.
That's crazy. Well, let's start there. Let's give us kind of the basic beats of the case of Scott's murder.
Hey guys, it's Ryan. I want to tell you about my new pastime, Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has been around for over a decade, delivering the most fun you can have online. Play social casino-style games for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
Yeah, so in 1986, I consider it winter. It'd be November. A guy named Scott Macklem, he's 20 years old. He's showing up to school at his college. And he's apparently, from what we can tell, he's got his key in the lock of his driver's side door to lock it because he's about to leave and go in and go to gym class. And this is at about 9 a.m. And all of a sudden, a shotgun blast rings out. Now, the people there at the time, especially if you have no familiarity with firearms, your mind doesn't immediately think firearms sometimes. Sometimes it thinks, well, it's a tire blowout or a car backfiring. But what happened here was that Scott had been shot probably from about 6 feet away by someone holding a shotgun. And that person had been able to make a clean getaway almost, right? Because when you hear a shot and you're not sure it's a shot and you're looking around, people are reporting that they saw a blonde woman crossing past that area to a car, getting in and leaving without looking like she was afraid that a gun had just been fired. This is what's reported. Mm-hmm. Also, there was a man seen wearing like a hat or a ski mask that was kind of pulled down up to here, you know, like on his brow. And then he's wearing an army style jacket. Now he's leaving. And so these are the things that the witnesses are reporting. And then that's where the investigation will start is, I mean, there were people walking past Scott's body after he'd been shot, and they just thought it was a guy working on his car. So you're talking about confusion. And all, at this point, all they have are eyewitnesses, ear witnesses, and then they'll eventually find a shotgun shell, and they'll also find an empty box of shotgun ammunition.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, everything about the, you know, from a behavioral aspect, when you're looking at like a crime scene, seems like, I mean, Scott was clearly targeted. Somebody had a they pulled up or walked up or however they got to him, shot him one time with a shotgun and left. They didn't hit any other victims, not multiple shots. He didn't get caught in some kind of weird crossfire. I mean, somebody went there with the intention of shooting and killing Scott. So before we get into Temujin's case, was it identified? Because I'm not, like I said, I'm somewhat familiar with the case, not intimately familiar with it. What motive did they attribute to Scott's death? Like, so they convict, again, at the time, Fred Freeman, Temujin Kensu now, of this murder. What was the reason? Did he have a connection to Scott? Because it seems like whoever did this had to have had a connection to him.
They shared a love interest. Her name was Crystal Merrill. She was Scott's age. And Temujin had met her back in the spring of that same year. And depending on who you ask, you know, if you ask Temujin or his people, they'll say, well, they briefly dated for some weeks. If you were to ask people who don't like him and think he's a guilty man, they'll say that wasn't really dating. He was coercing her into either letting him borrow her car or having her go with him places or to do things. And it was against her will, essentially. Like maybe the first time they went out, if you consider that a date, maybe that was, okay, I'll go out with you. But then after that, they say there was a lot of coercion going on. So the idea here from the prosecution standpoint is that Scott Macklem had to die because he and Crystal were expecting a baby and they were going to be getting married the following year in the spring.
And was the prosecution able to present any like convincing evidence of that other than just a theory?
Well, as far as I can tell, it's a theory because it's not like we have any documentation on that. We do have Crystal Merrill and her sister, Tracy, both saying that he had made threats, but that's all we have. There was no documentation. It's not like he wrote a letter and said, I'm going to kill him or anything like that. And as far as we know, he and Scott hadn't crossed paths too often. I think there was like one such encounter was at the place where Crystal worked. Apparently, they sized each other up there because at the time, Temujin, very much into martial arts, very fit, very careful with what he put in his body. And then you have Scott, who's a pure athlete. You know, he played basketball primarily at high school. So he's a, you know, he's probably a strong guy. He's probably a fairly fit man. But, you know, Temujin was not afraid of anybody. But definitely there was some looking at each other, sizing each other up kind of thing. And according to Crystal, Scott maybe was in danger because Temujin didn't want her seeing him. They had had a previous relationship, Scott and Crystal. And then after Temujin, sometime later, they got back together and they got more serious.
So there's at least a reason for Temujin to be a suspect. and you lay this out pretty well, and I'll have you just kind of just recap as much as you want to here without, you know, giving everything away. But most people that are familiar with the case know this piece of it. They identify this suspect, and then there's a whole bunch of witnesses that say he was not just like on the other side of town. He wasn't, at his mom's house somewhere around the corner, but he was in Escanaba, Michigan, which is in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, over 4 hours away with the Mackinac Bridge separating them from. And there was, what, 9 witnesses that said that he was up in the UP, is what we call it, the Upper Peninsula here in Michigan at the time of the murders. How do you feel about the validity of all those alibi claims about where he was at? And then how did the state overcome that?
They may not have to. Now, anybody who loves Michigan, I love Michigan. That's my state. That's my favorite state in the whole nation. We always hold up our hand when we're describing where things are at, right?
Yeah.
You know, are you in the thumb region? Are you in the palm? Or where are you at? Well,
yeah.
With the Upper Peninsula, you almost have to hold your other hand over, like you're putting.
Right, we use the other thumb. We do kind of like this.
Yeah, yeah. And then, yeah. So to give you some idea, really, when you look at the timeline of this case, you can find a way, I think, possibly, that you could say, well, there's probably a little wiggle room there, because his primary alibi witness would have been his girlfriend at the time, Michelle Woodworth, who claimed she was with him in bed in Rock, Michigan, or at least in their home there at 9 a.m. And that's the time that Scott was shot. So you can say, well, there's probably some wiggle room, because the last time anyone sees him is between 1:30 and 2 a.m. And then all of a sudden, it's like this shooting happens. So maybe he has time to get out there to where this shooting occurred. It's the coming back that's the problem, because it's going to take you a set amount of time at minimum to get back from Port Huron to Escanaba or Rock, Michigan. I mean, that's 436 miles or so, right, of travel. And then, right, of course, you have different areas you have to go through that have lower speed limits, or then you have to contend with, can your vehicle make it? The thing is the prosecution knew they had a problem with this alibi, because they kept harping on it, saying that he supposedly had a rock solid alibi. They almost mocked the alibi, like, oh, it's too perfect, meaning he made it up. You know, that's the only way it could be this perfect. The problem is they can't really get around it. So what they do is they introduce doubt. And one of the ways they do that is late in the trial, they bring up this idea that there was this plane that he got in, and the plane ferried him back and forth. But there are problems with that, because they never investigated that. Not truly. They didn't even look to see if they could find a record on this. There was no record to be found. And later, when journalists would ask these people at the airport that he would have used, like, is there any way he could have flown? And they're like, not in those conditions. We wouldn't have flown out that day, probably, because it was like 0 degrees or sub-zero. I mean, it was really cold in November in 1986 in Michigan, especially right, when you get further north.
Well, and so a couple things. One, also, I mean, just from a practical standpoint, the idea of just like throwing the shit at the wall and being like, oh, he could have used a plane, with no evidence that he used a plane, shit like that drives me insane when prosecutors do that to begin with. But also, from my understanding, Temujin and his girlfriend, they were broke, right? I mean, they were kind of struggling financially.
Yeah, you can. So that is something that is disputed. There's no question that he didn't have money, but he could have had money at times. There are people that say that women would do different activities, you know, questionable activities to get money for him, like fake charities, what have you. There's some suggestion. I don't remember exactly what it was, but somehow they say he did have cash. And you know how it goes. I mean, it's like that scene in Dumb and Dumber when he's like, oh, don't buy all these snacks because we don't have the funds to do it. And he goes, oh, no, don't worry. This came out of my own, you know. It's like,
yeah,
there are people that do that have no money, and yet they're going to gamble on a Sunday night when they're broke. You know, they should be paying the electric bill. They're paying the gambling establishment. So money aside, though, you have to, and you know this from your work looking into cases, you don't have to like the person. We have to know whether justice is occurring or not. And if you have no explanation on how to get around this alibi, to me, that's a big problem. Because we can put people away left and right all we want. And this country does that. You know, we lead the world per capita in imprisoning people. But it's like, we should be asking the hard questions. We shouldn't give any investigator an easy route to a conviction so they can move on and get their coffee. And that seems to be like what happened here, because they can't get around the alibi, because there are people that saw him at the karate school around noon. And there are people there that didn't really like him that much because they thought he was cocky or whatever. And they didn't get along with him that much, but he was there talking to him. And it feels like when you hear these conversations that, oh, he's setting up his alibi, but you still have to explain, how does he get from one place in Michigan to another that would take you many hours by car? All of a sudden you get there in less than 3 hours. It just doesn't make sense.
Yeah, there's no way. And it's and kind of what I was getting with the money is, and then we get into like the practical behavioral aspects of this is, he's got some cash, whatever, enough cash to charter a private plane to get down or to hop on, you know, that's one. And then also he's 400 and I'm telling you from living here, from where that he's at over in the Thumb region to Escanaba, it's a long 436 miles. Cause part of that, again, it was winter, it was cold. And part of the delay you have to factor in there is crossing that bridge. Crossing the Mackinac Bridge is not a quick little thing. Those miles are slow. There's usually lines. It often closes in the winter if it's too cold or too windy or anything like that. So he's essentially in a different world living up in Escanaba. And then one day decides, you know, in order for the prosecution's case to work, I'm going to squirrel away some money, charter a private jet or private plane to quick fly down because somehow I know exactly where Scott's going to be. And then, and also I've got a shotgun that I've somehow transported on this plane. And I'm going to get off the plane, go to where I somehow know where he is, go up, shoot him quick, go back to the airport and drive and fly all the way back. Like, it's like, when I just think about the practicality of that, like who, in what world does that make any amount of sense? Like this whole, not just the theory of the unproven theory with zero evidence to support it, but just the idea of it. Like, what is it? What is the triggering event in when he's in the Upper Peninsula for him to decide he's going to take all these steps like he's, you know, some super spy to come down and do this quick hit and then get back and then go set up his alibi? I mean, it's nonsense.
Yeah, and don't forget he'd need a car too from the airport he landed at to make it to the college. Not only that, but from information from those closest to Scott, he parked in the lot that day in an area he usually didn't park in. It's actually a fairly good sized school, different lots. Mm-hmm. He normally didn't park in that lot. So whoever
is it like a community college he was at?
Yeah. So St. Clair Community College. But the thing is someone would have to have had, they had to have followed him. That's the only way, because his whole, I guess you could say his whole way of doing things had been changing. He'd been erratically showing up to school. So when you look at all that, you think someone would have to have followed him, you know? So, I mean, if you have a narrative that, you know, either he had someone following him so he'd know where he was, they didn't have cell phones back then. How is all this communication happening for them to know what they should do, how he should be able to approach this crime if he was going to commit it with no cell phone? And if he's the one following the guy, then he would have had to know where to start from and follow him to where he was going and then make the hit. But if you listen to the prosecution's case, the prosecution says, oh, well, we have this witness, Richard Krueger, who saw a man snooping around the school, sneaking around the school and trying a door and this and that. And he describes someone that he thinks is Temujin Kensu or Frederick Freeman at the time. And that's like an hour before the murder. So in 0-degree temperature, someone's creeping around trying doors for what? You know, if your whole business is to follow this guy, then you already know where he is. And if you're setting up the story that someone's just waiting for him to show up and is snooping around, why wouldn't you be watching the parking lots? Maybe they're trying to say that he was going to go where he was expected to be in class. And how would he know that? So there are just too many questions here. And again, why would someone be outside an hour before Scott ever shows up snooping around for what? It just doesn't make sense to me.
Hello.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
And how long had Temujin been living in Escanaba prior to the murders?
I believe that he had made the move sometime after he says he split up with Crystal, that he made the move to get away from that area. So he moved to the UP to, you know, to get a fresh start.
It was like in the springtime, right? Like months before this.
Yeah, spring, early summer, somewhere in there. So he'd been gone for, you know, months. And,
right,
and that's another problem with the prosecution's case. Not that, you know, we can't definitively say that Temujin didn't have an interest in Crystal Merrill, because it certainly seemed like he did. But, you know, to say that, like, you know, 6 months down the road, all of a sudden he's like, oh, I'm going to take out her guy and then maybe she'll take me back. I don't really know how that works, because, I mean, he had to have been a suspect. So, you know, you kill somebody and then they're out of the way, but now everyone's looking at you. How are you getting back with her? And there's a whole phone call I go into that was monitored by the police, by a sergeant. And Temujin talked to Crystal for 4.5 hours on the phone, essentially, and talked to her about all kinds of things. But some of the stuff he talked about was the murder of Scott Macklem. He wanted the details on how he died, where he got shot at, you know, et cetera, you know, location on the body. And she would tell him, like, I don't know the details because my parents told me it's too horrible. And they don't want me to know what happened. But, you know, depending on your point of view, you might think he's either calling her to, you know, basically say, I'm not the guy that did this. Or he's also trying to say, maybe on the other hand, that I did this, but, you know, you're not going to be able to get me. I mean, who knows, you know, what the reason for the call was. But, you know, we have to trust in the testimony given by the sergeant and by Crystal, because this call was not recorded.
Oh, and I always love that, too, when you get everything. And because there certainly seems like, as you get into the nitty gritty details of the case, that there was some manipulation on the police part as far as some of the way the lineups worked and all that. And you get into all that, some of it already in the first couple of episodes of the case. But it's just one of those, you know, I'm always this Occam's razors guy. And it's like, so this guy's living 400 miles away for months and months and months. And we had to like think about this not in 2026 terms, where it's like, oh, look at what they tweeted and look at what they're posting. And this thing, there's the thing that's triggering you to, like, it's 1986. There's landlines and that's it. There's not even email. And he's all this ways away and then decides, yeah, and somehow knows where he's at and comes down there. Like, it all is crazy. How did he become a suspect to begin with? Because I actually, let me back up from that. As an investigator, I look at this case when I see the way the murder took place, this type of case more so than a lot of other types of cases, a deep study of Scott Macklem's victimology would be the most useful tool in this investigation. Like, he was targeted. Like, they should have been intimately focused on his victimology. Where were his risk factors? Who was he coming into contact with? Who would have a problem with him? Who would have it? Was a cursory look at victimology, is that how they ended up with Temujin on their radar? Because it just doesn't make sense to me that they picked this guy that's so far away. And then they find the alibi is like, well, he's there. It was around 9 a.m. that Scott was killed, right?
Right. It was 9 a.m.
Yeah. And then at like noon, there are people at the dojo or the karate gym that, again, this isn't his mother alibiing him or his girlfriend. These are just like random people that generally some of them don't even like him, saying he was there at noon. So 3 hours later, he's back up in Escanaba, and they still focus on him. So, like, how did they land on him as a suspect to begin with?
Well, first of all, when they did their investigation, like I said, they found two pieces of evidence. And, you know, one of the things that I think people forget is that there's a big difference between circumstantial evidence and direct evidence.
Yeah.
And if you just read that out, a lot of people might be mistaken and go, oh, direct evidence is better than anything. But I mean, the truth is that eyewitnesses get things wrong. They obviously don't know. The Ronald Cotton case is a case I bring up a lot. You know, a woman was attacked, assaulted, and she pointed out, you know, who did it. And then it turns out that the man who did it kind of looked like the guy she pointed out, but the guy she pointed out went to prison, you know, and they didn't get that figured out for a while. And of course, they'll say, oh, well, these people, they knew what they were seeing. But you don't know there's going to be a quiz, you know?
Right.
And I talk with Justin all the time, like, you know, when we think back, like, what did you have just 1 week ago? What did you have for lunch on this day? Now, if you're a creature of habit, you could guess. But it's not based on your memory of it. It's based on your knowledge of your habits. And when you're seeing someone you don't know, how do you know what you're looking at? And you have law enforcement saying, it's one of these people right here, so pick one. And you're going to pick the one that's closest to what you remember because you want to help out. And they'll say, all right, you picked either the right or wrong person, what have you. And then that person is now your focus. So like in this case, they didn't have anything going on. They didn't have any suspects. And I know what you're talking about when it comes to victimology. What was this person up to? Who were they in contact with? Were there threats? The only threats they could find and verify by any stretch of the imagination were the threats that were expressed to them by Tracy and Crystal Merrill. So when they give the name John Lamar, who's an alias, it's an alias of Frederick Freeman at the time, then they have someone to go on. And through their investigation, they find out that John Lamar is an alias of Frederick Freeman. So now they know he's been lying about who he is. Now it's even better. Then they look into that guy and they find out he's got some outstanding felony warrants, et cetera. So now they're like, whoa, now we got something. The thing is, and you know this to be true, I'm sure, just let me know if you feel differently, but there are times where law enforcement doesn't want the truth. They want to close the case. And there's a big difference there as well. And so if they can close the case, they've got a victory. And that's good enough for the family. It's good enough for the public. You're all safer now. But for the people that have seen a lot of wrongful convictions and know we can get it wrong, then we have to really question, how did you get there and did you prove it?
Yeah, 100% agree. I think that's what leads to most wrongful convictions is a rush to close a case. You know, everybody likes to look at things like this big conspiratorial, you know, through this conspiratorial lens, like, oh, the police wrongfully convicted him because they were framing him and they were, and certainly that happens. But most of the time when we have what I've found when I'm investigating cases like that, it's exactly what you're talking about. It wasn't because they had a problem with this one person and they were trying to frame this one person. They just wanted to close their case, and that was the easiest path to do it. And you see that in situations like if you're letting the evidence lead your investigation in this case, right? So you get this information about this guy that could be a suspect. Well, then, you know, the proper thing to do is then, of course, next thing you want to do is, do they have an alibi, or are they still a potential suspect? In this case, they find out almost immediately, oh, okay, he was 400 miles away. Letting the evidence guide your investigation should have said, okay, so not him, let's keep going and find out what other suspects do we have. But in this case, they're like, well, we've already decided, like, this is the guy we're going to close the case with. So instead of trying to see what the evidence is telling them, they try to find ways around the evidence. So much so that they end up with the idea of a secret plane that nobody knows existed, that he used, you know, to do this, all this like espionage type stuff to come in and commit this murder. The sad part about it is, I feel like this case was probably a lot more solvable than most people think. If the original investigators had done their job proper, if they hadn't been so focused on Temujin and instead were focused on the victimology and focused on where the evidence was leading them, the answer was probably sitting right in front of them. It's hard now. I mean, now we're 40 years later, but back then the answer was probably sitting right in front of them. And I want to circle back to where you pointed about, like, I love the way you put it, that when things are happening and people are witnessing things, they don't know there's going to be a quiz later. This case is a perfect example of that. And you do a great job of highlighting that in your second episode, where, like, all the different eyewitness statements, even the same eyewitness changing stories constantly. Like, people aren't paying attention. They're like, oh, it was They were wearing this. They were wearing a ski mask. No, they were wearing a hat. They had a, he had a beard. He didn't have a beard. He was clean shaven. The license plate number was one of these 12 license plate numbers, you know, that I'm giving you, right? So, like, these stories, like, people aren't, you're not recording. It's just like you said, like, people think it's a backfire. No one's expecting a gunshot. If you've never, if you're not in a place where there's constantly people be, now, here, down here in the county where I live, if we go into, like Benton Harbor, where there's shootings all the time, people hear a bang. It could be fireworks, and they're taking cover because they think it's probably gunshots because it happens a lot there. But in this case, they're not accustomed to there being constant gunshots. So when you hear a loud bang, your brain doesn't go to, oh, that was a gunshot. You know, your brain goes to whatever it normally connects a loud bang to, a car backfire, a firework, something like that. And so you're not paying attention to, like you said, there were witnesses that thought he's laying on the ground. They thought he was working on his car. He just got shot in the chest. You know, it was. So I don't want to go give too much of the case away, because I know you got a lot more work to do on it. How many episodes do you think we're expecting from season 3 of Framed?
Well, they're almost all done. I have all the primary episodes done, as I call them. There are 8 of those. There are 4 bonus episodes where on each of those, I have a guest and we go over the prior 2 episodes and discuss the things that need discussing. Because frankly, you know, when it comes to justice, I think another thing that we need to discuss is the fact that we have it in our minds, maybe wrongfully so, that if you're innocent of a crime, that you're an innocent person. And I think that is a big problem in this case. I think, quite frankly, a lot of the people that think he's guilty see his past behaviors, see what he has done or what has been testified to, and think, this is a horrible person. We've got to get him off the streets. But when we do that, when we make choices like that, we're denying justice for the victim. Because if he didn't do it, and certainly there's a lot of problem with, you know, their timeline, their evidence, not being able to crack the alibi, we're not getting justice for the victim. I don't care if the victim's family says, we believe in everything law enforcement and the justice system did here. You can tell yourself that all day long. But an independent audit of what happened, such as what you and I could do here, is vastly different. Because we're not invested in, we got to get the answer so we can sleep at night a little better. We're invested in, can they prove it? Because if we don't have to prove things anymore, we'll just see more and more people locked up and more innocent people locked up at that.
Yeah, and you're 100% right. I deal with that in several of the cases I've done in the past. You know, it's, I just see a difference in my listeners and their buy-in and their willingness to help. If the person who was wrongfully convicted, even when we're able to present, you know, here's a massive amount of evidence proving this person did not do this crime. If they've had a checkered past and they've had run-ins with the law in the past, and, you know, or, you know, just, you know, a girlfriend, an ex-girlfriend says this or that about them, that they're not a good person, then it's like, well, I don't want to help. But it's what I always try to keep my focus on is it's not really about that person. The work that I'm doing, the work that you're doing is not about that person. It's about the system. It's about, as you put it beautifully, this is about justice. You know, so it doesn't matter if you like the person or not. We have a criminal justice system that is supposed to be bringing on justice and convicting guilty people and getting justice for victims. So just because you don't like a guy and so we're going to lock him up for this crime, that's not justice and that's not the goal.
We need the system to work better. We need to expect more from our system. We need to be able to believe in it. And there have been too many cases with too many questions that they can't answer. And they're just like, ah, trust us. I don't believe in that. I don't believe in just trusting them. I want you to show me. You know, we have seen successful cases prosecuted where at the end of the day, we can go, hey, they had this DNA. We have this on video, what have you. And we've seen too many cases where they have nothing. And they get their conviction because maybe it was just bad representation, or they felt at the end of the day after, you know, the jury has to keep discussing the case and taking more votes. It's like, what are we really deciding here? Are you deciding what really happened, or are you deciding you're going to bet on one side or the other because you're trying to be done with it, you know? And I hate to say that that's what our system is, but that is what it is sometimes. It's as simple as someone just wants to go home, you know? And if you have a system that put away someone you're glad they put away, then you're a team player. I don't want team players. I want people that say, I'm independently minded and I'm going to look at this and judge it on the merits of what it is. So this justice system should be blind. It shouldn't say, well, Temujin's a bad dude. We're just going to put him away and we'll call it a day. It needs to be this individual who we're taking to court. We have to prove they did it. And if we can't, you know, and I know people are going to say, well, he was convicted in a court of law. I go through the trial. I can go through all of the aspects of the trial and explain exactly why this doesn't hold up. But that's what a lot of people want, is they just want to say, well, they got the right guy. They know what they're doing. And you know what? I mean, most of the time, the court system and the police, 90-some percent of the time, they're doing it right. We know that because there's 1-2% of people who are wrongly convicted. But with the numbers that we have in prison, that's still a lot of people.
Yeah. And regarding the jury and their deliberation, I always say, and a lot of people push back on this when I say it, but I would say if a jury deliberation goes on for more than a few hours, particularly if it goes into a second day, I don't trust the conviction. And the reason is the jury's job is to vote based on the evidence that was presented at trial. So when they sit in that entire trial and they hear all the evidence, and then they go into that jury room and they vote, if they heard all the evidence and voted not guilty, but then 3 days later they voted guilty, in my opinion, that change of vote, they didn't change their mind because of the evidence. They changed their mind because of something happening in that jury room. Pressure, exhaustion, like you said, I'm just done. I want to go home. Like, they're being convinced by the other jurors to vote guilty instead of being convinced by the evidence, because the evidence is what resulted in their first vote. And with that, we can go on and on about this for years.
12 sure angry men, getting, right?
Right, getting on my soapbox. But what I want you guys to do is go check out Framed. Give season 3 a listen. The first 2 episodes are out. You're releasing on Mondays, right?
So, yes, the episodes come out on Mondays. The first Monday of this season saw 2 episodes being released. And then on Thursday, which is July 16th, I have my first bonus episode out on the case. And then from then on, it'll be an episode a week, except for after every 2 episodes, there will be a bonus episode. So there'll be 12 episodes in total. That's the plan.
Great. So when you guys listen to this on Sunday, episodes 1 and 2 and the first bonus episode will already be out. And tomorrow, episode 3 will drop. So check out Framed. Give it a listen. And Aaron, thanks so much for joining me, man. It's great to catch up with you.
Thank you so much, Bob. Great to see you.
Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production, co-written and produced by Erica Bergenham. Music created and composed by Caden Ladislaw. Follow-up episodes are co-hosted by Janet Varney and Zach Weaver. Our logo font was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Our website is created, managed, and maintained by Katie Ross of createdintandem.com. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Erica Cantor, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Kaywood Yomnick, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Athey, and Caroline Dwyer. Truth and Justice provides all investigative and advocacy work for the wrongfully convicted completely free of charge. We're able to do that in large part thanks to you, our listeners, through your generous pledges on Patreon. Patreon accounts for the overwhelming majority of our funding. The number one way you can support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. For just $5 a month, you'll get all episodes ad-free, a bonus pregame episode every Wednesday, and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups exclusive to our patrons. Patrons also get to participate and join the chat live in many of our interviews and get early access to much of our content. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny and goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. You can always keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the official Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. You can also connect with us on social media platform X @truthjusticepod. And to follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Janet can be found at Janet Varney, and Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged and stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.
What's up, Foos? Main Event Jey Uso here from the WWE. When it's just me between matches, it's day one-ish. And that means it's Chumba time. With hundreds of casino-style games and new titles arriving weekly, there's always something fresh to try at Chumba Casino. The daily boosts make it even more fun. And have me about to get them all during my downtime. Ready for a fun way to chill out and enjoy a few minutes for yourself? Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.